production that would be very brief in this audience. You are all experts on this kind of subject. And then I will focus a bit on the UV behavior of diffuse type theories, on the infrared behavior that, as you will see, is a bit unexpected, and the possible fine-tuning problems in these theories, and then I will conclude. So it's important that I emphasize that my point of view is the one of a particle physics point of view, which means that I'm interested to consider theories that in the infrared will have Lorentz invariants back, okay, so very relativistic theories. Okay? Otherwise, the problem I'm going to address is actually not present at all. And in this framework, so we are in the, if you wish, more from the particle physics point of view, it is well known that if you introduce at the quadratic level higher derivative operators to your theory, then clearly the propagator are the improved behavior, and then you have some better renormalizable properties for your theories. However, as you know, if you do this in a Lorentz invariant way, higher derivative operators typically imply non-unitary theories, because essentially what you are doing is you are promoting to physical fields what are essentially polyvillar regulator fields. So you have you give a meaning to ghost fields, and then of course in this way you get essentially a breakdown of unitarity. Unitarity is one of the fundamental properties that we want to keep. The probability should be less than one. And then, of course, we don't want to use this approach, although I should warn you that it's people also are doing this approach. This is called the Bratz-Dicke theory, weakly theories in which you do this approach, hoping that actually this loss does not appear. But anyhow, we don't want to consider this. Instead, we want to do another thing. We want to explicitly break Lorentz invariants. At the end of the day, this is a global symmetry, so there is nothing very fundamental happens if we break it. And in this way, if you keep the time derivatives the quadratic level, you only allow for special derivatives, no ghost appear. So I should say that in the context of the non-gravitational context, this is maybe not so known, but there has been already done an extensive studies of this kind of theories for scalar, fermion, and gauge theories, so up to spin one, by Damian Anselmi and his collaborators in these four papers here. So let me take this nice. It's essentially, I mean, the framework is a bit different, the language is a bit different, and so on. And then, for some reason, these papers were not really well known to our community. Whereas instead, as we are all here for these reasons, the main recent interest on these theories actually came after Petr's beautiful paper on the possible way of having a renormalizable theory of gravity. Now, probably my talk, as well as the one by Sumit before, are the only one which are not really closely related to Orava theories, but so I will not enter into the issue of whether this theory is phenomenologically acceptable, is strong coupling, makes sense or not, and things like that. Okay, I will instead focus on what is, I think, the obvious, just crystal clear general drawback of any of these theories, not only the gravity Orava Lipschitz theories, but any kind of Lipschitz like theory. Relativistic, that is, how can we recover Lorentz invariants? We break it, actually, we don't even break it. More precisely, we just start in the ultraviolet with the theory that has no Lorentz invariants at all. Okay, it's not even broken. So, how can we recover? I mean, which is the hope that we have at some point? For instance, is there a possibility that there is some RG flow that under which all the Lorentz violating parameters just flow to zero? Okay, so this will be nice, of course, this will be great, actually. And indeed, along these proposals, already many years ago, Chadi and Nielsen have shown that in QAD, if you take a Lorentz violating version of QAD, some parameters, okay, you study the RG flow of some small parameters, if you spontaneously break the theory, like the case they were studying, the flow of the small parameter is proportional to the parameter itself. So at the end, depending on the sign of the coefficient, you can have either an RG flow IR fixed or UV equivalent fixed point, right? So if the sign is correct, we have 50% possibility that we get it right. They got right, and then they found that somehow this parameter was going to zero in the infrared. Unfortunately, very slowly, logarithmically, but anyhow, this was a possibility that one could have in mind. So we want to address this problem. We want to see if something like that can happen, and eventually, if how much and if any, this theory starts fine tuning. Okay? So what we want to do, since as you will see, working with this theory is not that easy at the quantum level, we have to drastically simplify the models we consider, and then we start to study scalar theory of this. And of course, there are many, in principle, many Lorentz violating parameters, so we have to do a choice. And our choice is to study the speed of light. Speed of light is a bit of a misnomer. We should call it, like Coleman-Gleeson said, the maximum attainable velocity for the particle. Speed of light, again, is an abusive language that, however, I will use. So we studied the different speed of light of the particle, and their difference are parameters which, of course, Lorentz violate. So we study this as just a benchmark parameter for Lorentz violation. And in addition to that, it should be said that these are actually one of the most constrained Lorentz violating parameters that we have in a theory. So our answer is actually pretty not promising, at least for weakly coupled theories. Okay? Of course, if you want to do something, unless you use some nice strong coupling argument, we work at weak coupling, and at weak coupling, we find that in general there is no way to get rid of the fine tuning into these theories. Okay? Roughly speaking, the RG flow is always logarithmic, as you might naively expect. So the naive expectation still is valid. The flow is so slow that at the end, you should, as I will show you, you should explain a fine tuning of this order of magnitude, and the RG flow at best, okay, if you are lucky with the signs, can help you to solve, say, two orders of magnitude here. So you can go from 20 to 80, okay? Which of course is not a big deal. And this problem was actually pointed out in a very general context, so beyond the Lipschitz theories, already by John Collins and collaborators in 5 years ago. So as if you wish, as a side remark, which I think is very important, you will see that our analysis will also, aside from the Lorentz violating issue, we also clarify a bit the quantum property of this of Lipschitz light theory. Okay, the quantum property of the operators in this case. So let me remind what we have heard already several times. So I want to spend 1 minute to this slice, because I want to point out what I believe is a better way of equivalent, but more transparent way of talking about these theories. So these theories, as we all know, are defined to having the ultraviolet this anisotropic scaling. And what I want to do here, actually following Anselmi, is to still use natural units. So my operators are always scaling dimension like the one we know. Okay, nothing is going to change. Simply introduce another kind of scaling that I will call weighted scaling, which is the one that you see here. Okay, so an operator will have two scaling: the class, this what I call the standard scaling dimension, which will be for a field phi will be d minus 1/2, the usual one. And then I introduce another scaling, which I call the weighted scaling dimension, which is the one associated to this transformation here, which will be instead the Lipschitz scale. Okay. Why I do that? Because in this case, I don't need to introduce, if you wish, unusual natural units, and then I should go to some other natural units, which is correct, of course, right? It's not wrong. But in this case, I think physics is more transparent. Okay, so the dimension of everything are the standard one, so C is dimensionless, a mass is a mass, and so on. Okay, but you should pay attention, of course, to the weighted scaling as well. Now, what is interesting is that the renormalizability of the theory, you can still use the standard textbook power counting arguments. The only things you have to do, you have to substitute in the standard arguments standard scaling dimension with weighted scaling dimension. If you just do that, then you use the Peskin-Schroeder or whatever textbook, quantum field theory book, and then you will get the correct power counting in this theory. So, for instance, in a theory, this is just a very schematic way of writing higher derivative operators. If you have an operator like this, this is clearly standard irrelevant. Okay, we are in four dimensions here, but weighted matching. Okay, so this is the usual generalization of the kinetic term. So just to give you an idea, in D equal to 3, space dimension, okay, so capital D will always be the space dimensionality, and Z equal to 2, the most general renormalizable Lagrangian for the scalar field under this scaling, okay, and here let me also remind you that there is always the question of frame, so I always assume that I have, oh, yes.
What about 5 to 6?
I mean, yeah, sorry, this is here. If you just wait a minute, I'm sure. So let me make this comment once and for all. Everything I'm said, I'm assuming a special rotation invariance, SO3. This is not a correct statement in a general frame, because if you boost, you break also SO3. So I assume that I am in the preferred frame. And in this frame, I have SO3 rotations. Parity, also for simplicity, I also assume time reversal symmetry, and also, of course, the translation. Okay. So essentially, I'm breaking the boost on it. So if you do that, the most general, strictly marginal operators are this one. So this is the kinetic term.
This is the interaction, and this is the other interaction. So you see that in my way of using natural units, you understand clearly that these are higher dimensional operators that, of course, then will contain some parameter that I call it lambda. So in this way of writing, A square, H2, and G4 are a dimensionless quantity, and lambda is some cutoff scale which tells me at which energy my theory becomes Lipschitz. So above the energy lambda, the theory is really of Lipschitz in nature. Below that scale, these operators are irrelevant, and I recover the usual Z equal to 1 regime. Okay? So, of course, these are only the strictly marginal operators. I can also put all the possible relevant terms, and these are here, mass terms, speed of light operators, all possible potential, and this type. Okay? So you see it's a very complicated theory. The propagator is, again, the quadratic terms here, so it's given by this. Okay? So as I told you already, there are two regimes of interest. I will call it the UV behavior, when the energy scale is greater than the lambda, whereas the infrared behavior here is when the energy is much less than lambda. So you see that even for a single scalar field, this theory necessarily are complicated if you want to study them in generality. And for these reasons, we prefer to go to higher dimension. Okay? We go to higher dimension because for a standard theory, higher dimensionality is bad for renormalizability, but with this technique that everything is much more renormalizable, if you go to higher dimension, you decrease the number of operators that you can write. So this is simply a simple tool to just decrease the number of operators that you want to study. Okay, for these reasons, we decide to study two models with different sign of the beta function in the ultraviolet. The first one is this one, the model in four space dimension. And this is it. This is the most general Lagrangian you can write. So, the marginal couplings are, again, this one, G here, and that K there. The other are weighted relevant. So we want to study if and how C squared, the speed of light that, for me, just to be sure in the notation, for me, C squared, the speed of light is simply the capping of the weighted relevant operator D pi squared. Okay, this is my definition of speed of light. We want to study how this operator run at one loop level. Okay, so this is the aim of our exercise. So we use dimensional regularization, and it turns out that it's enough to use dimensional regularization only in the spatial dimension. You don't need to do some dimensional regularization in the time dimension. And then we use, for instance, a mesh scheme in which we just subtract the poles in 1/S. Okay, this is not very important.
The speed of light, because you can always make C equal 1 by scaling the
sure, that's scalar. Why then I'm going to study a model with two scalars. Yeah, this is just the starting point. You are right. Yes. Okay, so this is,
of course, a bit technical. I just want to give you in these slides a bit an idea of how you standard well-known technique generalizing this into this more complicated framework. So this is, for instance, a typical graph, okay, the external momenta is zero, that will renormalize the 5^6 cap in the sphere. Okay, this is very standard. And you write this in the usual, okay, everything is pretty clear. But at some point, you see that you have to face with this complicated propagator, but you can do this with standard Schwinger, introducing Schwinger effective parameter alpha. And then, okay, but doing some algebra, you can get the pole in 1/x. So LD will be the loop factor, the analog of the loop factor in a standard Lorentz invariant plane. So if you do this manipulation, then you get the beta function for your marginal coupling. So in this theory, the coupling A is just accidentally, it has a non-trivial structure only at two loop level, so it doesn't run. And then we have this running for G and K. Okay, G and K, I recall you are the two interactions in this theory. So, maybe it's a triviality, but then you realize that in this theory, actually, the effective coupling is not the one appearing in the Lagrangian, but we are divided by the coupling of the highest quadratic term in spatial derivatives. So these are the real effective coupling in the theory. It's G over A to some power and K over A to some power. So you, yeah.
If you can go back, do you have another a fixed point, a non-Gaussian fixed point, and then some zero there?
Yeah.
Yes.
We haven't studied all the possible solutions of this.
That would be interesting, I think.
Yeah, maybe it's interesting, but as you will see, we are not that interested to this kind of solution, yes, because K will not just have, yeah, but yes. Oh, by the way, just to remind you, A is this operator, it's the coefficient proportional to the
Clark, could you explain why you define the Hadid couplings, why they're the correct ones to look at?
Well, they are correct because at the end you see that this is the UV regulator of the divergent graph. When A goes to zero, you go to strong coupling because essentially you are removing what makes your theory really normalized. That's if you wish it's the physical feature that you have. And then this, of course, will come out from the expression that you get when you see that you get 1/8. So you get possible singularities when A goes to zero, which is expected because you are removing the operator that makes you a good theory, no? And improve the UV behavior. So you can solve this simple RG equation, of course. So T will always be the usual log of the scales. So mu zero is some given reference Transplanckian or whatever, very high energy scale mu zero. And then we study the theory as it flows for T negative, okay, so through energy. You can study also from bigger than mu zero, of course. So this is what we get. We get a theory that has a lambda of all, okay, it's like the standard 5^4 theory. So the lambda of all appears at this very high scale. So of course, we can trust this analysis only in this regime. Okay. So I said for simplicity, I said two units in which this lambda, the scale in which we have the regime, the transit regime, equal to 1. Okay, so the lambda is equal to 1, and this is the regime in which you can trust this two formula. Once you know how the marginal couplings run, you can study also the relevant couplings, and the speed of light transits this way, is proportional to itself, because this is the only relevant couplings. If you switch it off, and its isotropic scale tells you that this cannot run, this is a fixed point, so it's like a mass time for a failure, so you learn that it's the function proportional to itself, and you get this kind of running. Okay. So you see that in the ultraviolet, the speed of light runs logarithmic. Now, of course, as correctly pointed out, if you have only one field, it's a bit, you can always rescale one cap in your theory to one by a simpler definition of the field. So it isn't, so if you wish, with one field only, you essentially always recover by simple dimensionality Lorentz invariance of flow energy. Okay, it's a trivial fact. The non-trivial issue arises if you have at least two particles. So we do the same game with two particles. So this is the same Lagrangian for phi 1 and Lagrangian for phi 2, and some extra times that interaction times between phi 1 and phi 2. And V12 is another relevant relevant sets. So this is again the most general Lagrangian that you can write, considering normalizable, SOT invariant, time reversal, and so on. So you see there are many types, so yeah, of course I will not enter into the details, the beta becomes a bit more complicated, but I just show you how this beta function reads. These are the beta function for the two speed of light that you get. Okay? Nevertheless, you can, despite the complication of the beta function, you can find the exact solution. Some you can find this simple ansatz, in which you take all these curves to be equal to each other, in which case the equation becomes algebraic equation for this three unknown, actually four unknown, x also. And then so there are various solutions for this unknown x, g0, h0, and so on. And then you find that the speed of light and the
difference of the two speed of light, okay, if you wish, this is the main speed of light and this is the difference, I change it now variable, you get this two kind of light. So again, you see that the speed of light runs logarithmically and also the Lorentz violating delta C runs logarithmically, okay? Of course, you can study perturbation around this simple exact solution, and it turns out that you can also solve for small perturbation. So you can write the G1 as G plus some small perturbation, G2 as some other small perturbation, so on. And then you can find how this little perturbation evolves with the energy scale, and this is what you get. And in this more complicated setup, you see that the Lorentz violating parameter does not run only proportional to itself, but there are also extra terms that do not depend on delta C zero squared. Okay? That shows you that on very general grounds, it's not even enough. So contrary to the case in which you have a spontaneous Lorentz breaking, in which you are insured by just the Lorentz symmetry, the fact that you have spontaneously broken the Lorentz symmetry, that this is always true. In the Lipschitz regime, which at high energy, actually, there is no Lorentz symmetry in any sense, you in general have that even if you switch it off this term at some scale, then this is generated by the other terms in the field, you see? So even if you start with delta C zero equal to zero, exactly zero, then delta C at low energy is generated by the flow of this other term. So just to give you an idea of how the problem with the fine tuning is present, so here I just, I always take C zero equal to one, the average speed of light. Then you can take, for instance, you can fine-tune your parameter, the small variation of the coupling to be zero, and then you start with delta C squared, say, 10 to the minus 8. You do a running over 40 orders of magnitude, and you, from 10 to the minus 8, you go to 9.6, 10 to the minus 9, 9.5, 10 to the minus 8. Just to give you just a few, just a glance of, sorry, a taste of the amount of fine-tuning that we are talking about. So here, similar story, but I take now a different attitude. I say, okay, I take delta C zero, exactly zero, and then I allow for some small coupling delta G zero and delta H. So you start in the deep ultraviolet with no Lorentz violating parameter by construction, and then you see that the RG flow suddenly gives you values that are of order much bigger, of course, completely unacceptable, of order 10 to the minus.
So physically, you would think that if you have two different speeds of sounds and there's interaction between the two fields, and if one particle is moving, it can actually have chunk of radiation in the other field, basically. So that means that the particle isn't really free because you don't have really, it cannot move with a constant speed because it keeps radiating particles of the other field. So then I wonder if that suggests that your theory is strongly coupled, you cannot really trust perturbation theory at low energies.
No, I don't think so. I mean, all the possible effects that, as you correctly pointed out, arise when you have different speed of lights, like Cherenkov,
exactly.
Many other crazy things, are not necessarily, actually, are not a manifestation of strong coupling. So, for instance, I will discuss a bit.
But then you don't have free particles, that's what my point. You cannot.
If you have free particles, Cherenkov effect will never appear. They only appear because.
But anytime a particle moves faster than the speed of sound of the other field, it does emit Cherenkov radiation.
It emits if there is a coupling, otherwise it would not emit.
But there's always a coupling.
And then it's not free. Okay, but
Can we just see the formula once again? The one? No, just
this one?
Yes, this.
Yes.
So if the two scalars are not coupled to each other at all, wouldn't this?
Yeah, yeah, they are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
They couple, right?
Yeah. Yeah, they couple.
So if they don't couple at all, then this delta C square will go to zero, right?
No, if they don't couple at all, then the delta C will run independently.
Can you
will not talk to each other, but on their own, they will have different running on their own.
Sure, but then can you just rescale the field somehow?
You can scale one, but the other, you have just one scale.
If you have two separate, absolutely identical branches, then of course it will run the same way. But if you have a higher dimensional operator, slightly different, the transportation to a lower dimensional operator will occur differently. So you will have another.
Sure, but.
It just points that you have to start with Lorentz invariant theory for matter, right? And the gravity should be.
Yeah. But, okay, let me. Okay, so this is the first Kubitschek toy model. The second is even more toy, okay? But it's interesting because this is now a UV3 model. Okay, the other I'll show you as a Landau pole in the some energy scale. This is instead a very simple theory. It's just a 5-cube theory in 10 dimensions, okay, times spatial dimension, 11 dimensions. So this theory turns out with z equal to 2 to be just renormalizable. And you see the beauty of this theory that is really very easy. The most general Lagrange is like that. And then we can do the same game. You study at one loop level the evolution of the coupling. So I will not repeat, of course, I will just give you the results. You will get that, once again, the effective coupling are some rescaled version of this coupling. For instance, lambda, the real coupling governing the loop-wise expansion is this x, which is lambda square over a to the phi. And this object run as a logarithmic running, which is UV3, okay, at very high energy, goes to zero. And the speed of light instead, again, has this kind of logarithmic dependence on the scale. Now, you can do the, again the same story, very simple. You double the two fields. Now, for technical reasons, since this is a cubic theory, by the way, sorry, a cubic theory is clearly non-physical, no? It's the potential is unbounded from below, so this theory does not make any sense at all. I should just warn you. Nevertheless, this has nothing to do with the issues of the ARC, so you can trust, you can see this theory is just a very toy model for instance of gauge interaction, which you know you can have, you have this cubic interaction. So all this issue of the is clearly stability of this theory has nothing to do with the ARC flow that I'm showing you. So you can take two fields. For simple reasons, I introduce a parity symmetry Z2 according to which eta goes to minus itself, so that I simplify a bit the number of interactions. I have one less. In this way, I have only two possible interactions here. Then you study the RG flow once again, okay? And again, what you get is essentially the same story as before, okay? Nothing really changes. And the main message is that the RG evolution of delta C square, okay, that cannot help in alleviating the fine tuning to get delta C small at lower energy. Okay, that's the main message. Okay, so what I showed to you so far was the behavior of the flow for energies much higher than lambda. Okay, now if you have in mind, I don't know, for instance, in Orava-Lifshitz theory, lambda you would expect to be M Planck. Okay, you believe that the Orava theory is really a renormalizable theory of gravity, the only scale you have is M Planck, so the most natural choice of this lambda would be M Planck. Of course, you can choose other scale, but this is the typical scale. If this is the case, you see that you don't want to know the running of the coupling at the trans-Planckian level. Okay, you might want to know, but it's not that interesting. You might want to know how a given coupling runs at very low energy, okay, because we observe the photon speed, I mean, we observe photons definitely at energy below M Planck. Right. Now, here it turns out that there are some, here I think it's what is makes physics becomes more interesting. In these theories, due to the structure of the propagator, even without any mass, it turns out that you cannot use mass-independent scheme as we have done so far. Okay? And in order to explain to you this point, I want to go back to very general
argument of, I want to remind you very simple facts about the quantum field theory, standard quantum field theory theory. Okay. In conventional theories, the MS scheme, as you know, might know very well, has to be used with care because it's a scheme in which the Appiah-Piskaryk-Zone theorem does not decouple. In other words, in the MS scheme, you naively find that the beta function of, in a theory does not depend on the mass. You have, say, in 5 to the 4 theory, for instance, you have the beta function is whatever number, doesn't depend on the mass, it's always there. Of course, this is not true, because you know very well from physical argument that when the energy scale goes below the mass of the particle you are integrating out, the decoupling effectively stops running. Okay? So this is an input that you have to put by hand in your theory if you are using a mass-independent scheme, whereas if you use a mass-dependent scheme like momentum subtraction or the one typically used when you really teach quantum field theory or you learn quantum field theories, then this is automatic. The beta function is very complicated, and automatically you see that the below the mass scale of some particle, the beta function goes to zero. Okay? Now, what it turns out in this theory is that even if there is no mass, okay, this theory here is like a mass. At low energy, this theory becomes a mass, and then the RG behavior of this theory gets modified. This, of course, is unobserved. Is if you use MS scheme, you just don't see this effect. So you have to be very careful. And for these reasons, since these are unusual theories, unconventional theories whose renormalization group properties were unknown, we decided to do now the study in the infrared using just momentum subtraction, okay, a more physical scheme. And let me recall you the beta function in 5 to the 4 in this scheme. So this is, of course, a very known, this is the usual Lorentz invariant 5 to the 4. I remind you that the standard things to define the coupling is you take some value of the Mandelstam variables at some, for instance, Euclidean momentum, you don't need to be on shell, it can also be off shell, to be equal to your lambda. Okay? This is your definition of lambda. Okay, once you do that, everything is normalizable. Sorry, everything, you have subtracted the divergences. The full finite four-point function will look like this one. Okay, thanks to this subtraction, now the infinity is gone. And then you use Callan-Simansky equation, the number of dimension is zero at one loop level in this theory, to give you that the beta function is just mu day in the mu of this factor. It's really a straightforward computation, and then you find that the beta function is this one. Okay. You can also do this integral with some arc tangent. This is not important. The important point is that you see the standard beta function that you would get in the MS bar is just this one. Forget this integral, you get just a 3 lambda square over this. It's mass independent. The beta function, a mass dependent scheme, is this. Okay. The physical scheme is this one, so this is in some sense the true beta function, although this is a misnomer. Okay. The beta function has not an intrinsic meaning in itself, it's scheme independent. But in this scheme, you really see the physics. Okay? In this scheme, you see that if mu, the sliding scale, is much higher than m, this factor cancel, this factor all cancel, you get 1. So you recover the MS scheme. If mu is much less than m, however, you see that you can neglect this term, and then you get that the beta function goes to 0 like mu over m squared. So in this scheme, you really see that for energies below the mass of the particle, the beta function stops. So the running freezes. Okay, as it should happen. So, since due to this infrared effect, the computation now becomes more complicated, we just study the 10-dimensional case, which, as you have seen in the theory, is easy. So what we do momentum subtraction. So we take the two-point function, the three-point function, and then we define everything at a given scale. So this is the wave function normalization. Then we define the speed of light to be the second derivative at zero momentum of gamma 2, this is the fourth derivative of A squared, and then we define also the coupling to be, I mean, the standard story that you can imagine. Everything done at some scale mu. Now, for technical reasons, we take the scale mu to be equal only to the time-dependent part. We take the space-dependent part to zero, because in this theory is the space-dependent part is quartic, so this complicates a lot at the technical level, but this is just the technicalities. You solve the beta function, you get the beta function for A, anomalous dimension, for lambda, and so on. Now, again, this is to give you a glance of what you get. You shouldn't we shouldn't pay too much attention if you're not interested. So this is the typical expression that you get, for instance, for the anomalous dimension of in this theory. You see that you get a form which is now very much dependent on the energy scale and all the York parameters. And from here, you see that if mu, the sliding scale, is much bigger than lambda, more precisely C over A times lambda, then you are in the Planckian regime, in which case your anomalous dimension you recover precisely the factor here that I remind you was the MS, the factor we found in the other scheme, in the MS, which is, of course, it's a check that we are doing the things correctly. But then in this scheme, we can also reliably go to the infrared, because now this is a really physical scheme. There are no issues about possible decoupling effect that you are missing. And in the infrared, we see that actually the anomalous dimension goes to zero as mu over one. Okay? And again, this is due to the fact that C squared, K squared, the relevant coupling, okay, just it's not a must-have, it's just a relevant coupling, but at the end of the day, it acts like an infrared regulator. And then from the point of view of the Lipschitz observer, this is like a must-have. And then the coupling prints. Okay? So stated in another way, again, the infrared finiteness of this theory, which is due to this term, without this term you have a bad infrared divergences here, is responsible for the freezing of the coupling. So this is the main message I want to give you, aside from the fine-tuning, of course. The marginal, weighted marginal couplings in the Lipschitz theory, below the scale where the theory actually goes to the z equal to 1 theory, they all freeze. They are all, they go to constant. So for instance, in the lambda phi to the cube theory, you have a UV-free theory, which do not develop any strong coupling singularity in the infrared, not like you see. You have our coupling is UV-free, but at some energy scale of order lambda, the coupling freezes. Okay? So I think the message is clear, and this is not an accident of this toy model phi to the phi cube. The lesson is that the weighted marginal operators becomes inoperative when mu is much less than lambda. So now the natural question to ask is, okay, good, but then C square and delta C square, should also they freeze? I mean, I show you that before the C square and delta C square were running due to this marginal coupling. So do they continue to run in the infrared or they also freeze? And the answer is that, well, as far as the RG flow driven by this weighted marginal operator is concerned, they freeze. But then other operators come in, which are what are marginal now in the z equal to one set. In other words, you have to use really the two languages. At Trans-Planckian energy, the important operators are the weighted marginal. At sub-Planckian energy, the important operators are the standard marginal. Okay, so in all contexts, you have to look at the marginal operators. Simply, what is marginal in the UV is not the same as the marginal in the infrared, as simple as that. So this, just to give you an example of what happens, now we go to a theory which has nothing to do with Lipschitz in principle. So this is just a very simple example. So imagine to have a Yukawa theory in standard dimension, that this is an infrared effective theory of some UV Lipschitz theory, which, for instance, I don't know, the Z factor of phi is known 1, or psi is Z equal to 2, or whatever. We don't mind, you know? You see, at low energy, we are sure that the relevant operators are this one. Okay, just the standard relevant operator. All the rest is completely negligible. But the only things we know is that due to this UV completion that is completely Lorentz breaking, in the infrared, we know that C phi is not equal to C psi. This is the only thing we know. Okay, so this is the only thing we know. And of course, we assume that by some fine tuning, C phi and C psi differ by a small amount. So here we can do just really, you can take now standard textbook and do this stupid exercise of taking different speed of light. Then you will find the beta function, this Yukawa theory, which are very simple. You get this is the usual running of the coupling, the Yukawa theory. I recall you as also Landau pole in the ultraviolet. And then you find the speed of light. You see that the speed of light, now we are in the infrared, okay, still runs logarithmically, but now driven by what is the marginal coupling in the infrared, okay? And you also see how the speed of light, for instance, of psi, same story for phi, of course, runs logarithmically. So it's energy dependent, right? Okay? It depends on the some scale at zero, and then it evolves according to this formula. So you see, again, the Lorentz symmetry break in the infrared, okay, which comes from some UV Lipschitz theory, it's induced by quantum effects and energy-dependent speed of light.
Which alpha is simply g squared. Oh, g squared over 4 pi.
So let me go now to some numbers, okay? So I think the beautiful paper that I suggest you to give a look, if you don't know, it's by Coleman and Glashow 11 years ago, in which just by very simple arguments such as Cherenkov radiation and neutrino oscillation and all that, they found that essentially all ordinary particles, proton, photon, neutrinos, kaons, but not all, some of the ordinary particles have strictly severe constraints on their different speed of light. In other words, if you study the difference C proton minus C photon, C neutrino minus C other neutrino, things like that, you find that typically this delta can be should be less than this number here. Okay? Which is, of course, very severe. And moreover, nowadays, more recent, we have also some more indirect experiments to show that the energy dependence of the speed of light itself, not only of the delta, but just you take a single species, say the photon, and then you study if this is energy dependent or not. And for this, it's very useful to use, for instance, Fermi. Fermi has observed some gamma ray burst, okay, this is the name, and they found the delay in the gamma ray due to the high energy between the high energy part and the low energy part, there was some delay in time, which actually has been also suggested to be cured by Urawa Lipschitz and some other thing. But we take here the more conservative point of view. Fermi says that C square of the speed of light of photon at 1 MeV minus the 1 at 10 GeV should be less than that. Okay, and you understand from here, if you go back to our result, that this implies that really there cannot be such a big energy dependent in the speed of light.
Delta C over C, because this, again, you can always rescale your C. So this is dimensionless number, right? So really should be delta C over C.
Normalizing on C.
You have to normalize to C.
C is what? I'm always thinking, anytime you don't see C is what?
Right, okay, so that's related to my, so do you find that delta C is proportional to C squared itself? Your delta C squared, say, the two scalar example.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so maybe this is something I want to emphasize. So there is just a difference between the running of the speed of light in the infrared and the ultraviolet. In the ultraviolet, the running is really wide, in the sense that you always have a running of everything, speed of light, difference of speed of light, and so on. In the infrared, if you fine-tune, it's simple. In the infrared, you have the possibility of having an emergent symmetry, which is Lorentz. So if you fine-tune delta C to be zero, exactly zero, in the infrared, then you see that there is no delta C uses. This is zero, and this is equal to this at any energy, okay? So if somehow delta C zero is exactly zero in your low energy theory, then you are fine, because really, here accidentally, this is equal to that, you see that
In UV, is your delta C squared proportional to C squared?
Mm-hmm. Always C squared,
yeah.
Yes.
Beta functions.
Yeah.
It should be.
It's always C squared.
The delta C square.
Yeah, C square. Either C square or delta.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. Okay, so
just on the last point you made, maybe Rob or Maxim could clarify this, but I wonder why you and other people quote this bound instead of one that's a billion times stronger, namely from the Myers and Pospov effective field theory analysis of QED. If you're looking for energy-dependent changes in the speed of light, there's only one term you can write down that's a dimension 5.
Operator. Yeah, no, sorry. This is a point in which this is a point that should be clarified. So the effect discussion with people studying this dispersion relation. So this is different. There you parameterize your dispersion relation in terms of a standard. A square, say P squared plus higher dimensional operator. Here the effect is different. It's much more problematic, and this is along the lines of points. This is telling you that at the quantum level, there are no local effects that are like the log of the energy, which is not a local operator that you are writing. It's not a local operator. You cannot write this as a local operator. This is a quantum effect which is not local. It's a log of an energy which does not admit a local expression. So this is wider, this is more dramatic than the higher dimensional operator. The higher dimensional operator is still there. If you reach the Lipschitz piece at three levels, this is the energy or the speed of light energy is k squared plus k to the four. Trivial. This is three levels, trivial. And this is can be small if lambda is small. This
so
is
you should, so I should regard this as a bound on a non-local term in the...
No, it's not a non-local term. It's the simple fact that you shouldn't insist on the... I mean, it's the standard things. A loop computation shouldn't be written as a local terms in the action. This is the fusion. This is the two-point function. The two-point function has a non-analytic text. It's not effective action. It's a simple...
Can I insert one line? This is just constrained on dimension four operator, right? You can write for
no, because there's no energy dependence of this.
Dimension four doesn't have any energy dependence, right? You take E squared, and instead of subtracting V squared, you subtract something, you know, one plus delta C of V squared, and that's what it is. It's dimension four operator, it's dimensionless.
He's comparing the speed at 1 MeV and...
Okay. Sorry. That's dimension six, yeah.
Or five.
Or five or six.
So wait, so this is what... I know it's not really your main point, but since there's so many assembled, and it's always bothering me that people are focusing... Either I don't understand...
No, look, I mean, to me, this is really... the sense I want to give is very simple. It's the analog of half in QAD. So half in QAD up to 1 EV and 100 GB is different. 137 in one case, 100 over 28 or whatever in another case. But this does imply that in the QAD you introduce an higher derivative operator. It's just the usual loop running. No? The coupling constant as measured at low energy is 1 over 137. At the Z mass, it's another number. This is why, well, running of the coupling. This is the message I want to give you. You measure in your experiment the speed of light.
But if that were true, then there should be an effective Lagrangian that would incorporate that energy dependence of.
What do you mean? In QAD, you have an effective Lagrangian that would. This is a loop effect. No, you don't mind. I mean, this is a normalizable Lagrangian.
I don't have to change the coupling at different scales. I can use it at one scale and just calculate, and I have loop correction.
Exactly. The logic is like in any normalized field.
But there are no loop corrections in the ordinary QED Lagrangian that would induce a variation like this.
Well, of course, because it's Lorentz invariant. But I mean,
so what are we bounding? That's what I don't understand. What term in the effective Lagrangian is this constraint bounding?
Listen, on the difference between this operator, the coupling of this operator with this operator. This is what is bound. Mm-hmm. This operator has to be very smooth, close to each other. Otherwise, you are breaking the seal.
I'm sorry, but I don't know.
We can discuss later, okay.
Is it a bound on dimension four, Lorentz violating operators?
Yes.
As opposed to higher dimension operators.
What's the operator?
I don't see.
There are two effects. Now, one is, as I said, it's very clear, it's the difference between the two different operators, in this delta C. This is the first problem number one. And the other problem you can have only with a single species, which is the fact that depending on the energy, this coupling changes. What I'm arguing, but apparently we don't have an agreement, is that this extra fact, the fact that a coupling can run with energy doesn't imply the introduction of other operators in the Lagrangian. Like in QAD, you don't need them.
Ted is asking, what are the terms in the Lagrangian which are responsible for the running?
But is that simple? I mean, the Lagrangian is not Lorentz invariant. By the time you come out, it's not Lorentz invariant. No, there is no symmetry due to that that forbids you what otherwise you should allow, and what is typically allowed is that the speed of light runs like the coupling constant of QAD. We are not used to that because we are used to Lorentz invariant theories in which the symmetry, Lorentz invariance, tells you that this is equal to this at all energies. Forget this. We tell you that you shouldn't even think about this thing. If you have Lorentz invariant. But if you don't, this is what happens. This coupling becomes like alpha in QAD. Thanks to the energy. Okay, so...
I don't want to, lunch is waiting for us. So let me conclude. So I think we have analyzed very simple model, which are not even gravity, but even a very simple non-gravitational theories, which are the simplest one, scalar theories. And we try to study in some quite detail the one-loop RG evolution of these Lipschitz scalar theories by focusing in particular on the, well, okay, speed of light operators here. So there are, again, let me emphasize this point, two regime of interest. This is what you would have expected, by the way. The Lipschitz regime, in which the operators are classified by their weighted scaling dimension, okay? And the RGE is governed essentially by the weighted marginal operator. Okay, these are the ones that you should look at. Of course, there are no weighted irrelevant operators because this theory is supposed that you want to write a renormalized theory. In the deep infrared, on the other end, the operators are essentially classified. You should really use the standard scaling dimension. And these operators becomes now irrelevant in this standard sense. They freeze, they're completely irrelevant. Not only they're irrelevant, this is a classical statement, but what we are showing is that even their coupling just freeze. And the RGE of the remaining Lagrangian is essentially governed by the standard marginal operator, right? The weighted coupling. So as far as the speed of light is concerned, I show to you that both the speed of light in itself and their difference, if you have more species, is logarithmically evolved with energy. And again, this is governed by the weighted marginal operator. Whereas in the infrared, they still run logarithmically unless all sources of Lorentz symmetry breaking vanish. If by accident all sources of Lorentz breaking are zero, then of course the global symmetry tells you that you don't, nothing breaks. Okay? But it's clear, I think the main message I want to convey to you is that you really need a dynamical mechanism to keep all Lorentz violating parameters more. Okay? Otherwise, in order to do these Lipschitz theories, gravitational or not, so promising theories of particle physics. We don't want to introduce dozens of fine tuning of 20 orders of magnitude. Okay, thank you.
In a similar path of Anselmi and collaborators. So I just looked to see what it was that he was up to. And he had some fantastic sounding claim that also doesn't seem consistent with what he told us. Namely that he could make a Lorentz violating version of the standard model that's Lipschitz type theory, it's UV finite, and it's got low energy Lorentz symmetry. So what, can you please resolve the discrepancy?
Okay. I haven't read in full detail that paper because this is if you wish an application, it was not the fundamental principle that had the other paper. Yeah. So in that paper, I think essentially he wants to introduce four Fermi operators at the renormalizable level. If you Lipschitz size in standard model, four Fermi operators can become renormalizable, of course. And then he wants to use this as a Ion Alassini model in which you control, blah, blah, blah. I mean, this is the idea, yes. Without X and so on. But if I'm not mistaken, this issue is still there. I mean, he's very well aware of this issue, but the issue of the tuning to get Lorentz invariants at the infrared.
So,
I mean, this is a future trigger issue that at the end nobody cares, but it's there because it's.
Yeah, I don't see how to avoid it, but it sounded like.
It's there. I mean, you see, it's so. It's so clear that it's there sometimes that one even doesn't wish, which is to me it's not that fair, that physical, but it's there. I mean, okay. I can assure you. I talked with him several times.
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to repeat the point that I made yesterday for everybody. That I think the conclusion about fine tuning in your framework, of course, is justified, but you could make a hierarchy of two scales, the crossover scale and the Planck mass, right? If they're very much hierarchical, you could localize Lorentz violation to gravitational sector and have complete Lorentz invariance. So none of the higher dimensional operators that you're talking about in the matter sector. And then you turn on the gravitational interaction, the communication of the two sectors will induce effects that are lambda squared over M Planck squared. Okay. And in that sense, with the hierarchy of two scales, you can make it, at least you have a hope of keeping it under control. So
this is, let me
we already discussed it, but yeah. So I agree with you, but I'm not totally sure that this framework eventually can make sense, in the sense that you have to take a full theory, full Lagrangian, you split it in two sets. One is an isotropic scaling in the deep ultraviolet, the other is not. And then at the quantum level, of course, I will get, although plus Planck suppressed, you will see that you might be going to generate higher derivative operators for the standard model, which you might not mind at the end, you know? But the how much the full framework makes sense as far as fine-tuning is concerned, to me is not clear. I mean, to me it's not clear how much really you can systematically do this kind of artificial splitting, and demanding a symmetry only in a sector of the theory, which couples with the other, by the way. And the amount really of naturalness that you get. But of course, I invite you or whoever to do this. Of course, I'm open minded. I will be happy.
Well, what I'm saying, that all interactions with gravity are 1/Planck suppressed. So then, therefore, whatever you have is going to be you know, require an energy scale in the mirror. Make the hierarchy of two scales. You have a hope of maintaining -20 without, you know, tuning the 241.
Maybe I'm too conservative, but to me it sounds a bit artificial. That you write a Lagrangian, you say this is Lorentz invariant by Fiat. Gravity is completely.
I give you an example. Take a crystal and propagation of neutrinos there, right? Clearly, you know, like the influence of the crystal and neutrinos is nil, right? So, or very, very small, just because the interactions are too weak, right? So it's not.
No, I understand, but here, this is my prejudice on the theory, if you wish, of everything, not in subset. I would love to have a fundamental principle and not to have. But okay, I mean, it's. I don't have any strong scientific argument against you. It's okay. I take the
thought. In some sense, you can argue that the Lorentz correlation in gravity is some sort of environmental effect.
No, but I agree. Right? We don't need for the other forces the Lipschitz improvement. We don't need because the standard model likely is already renormalizable on its own, or GATT or whatever, so whatever you like. So.
I was wondering about the following naive question. We always do field theories on a lattice. They break all kinds of symmetries. Right? I mean, of course. It was Wilson's great realization you need to keep gauging brackets on the lattice. But eventually, in the continuum limit, you always regain, you know, Euclidean, Lorentz invariant, same speed of light for all the fields. So, how does that happen?
Yeah, okay, this is a very good point. I thought about that from the emergence. But to me, it's not clear in the sense that it seems to me, but I'm not an expert, so I might say nonsense here. It seems to me that even in condensed matter system and in all other systems in which you start on the ultraviolet with some explicit breaking, say, of SO3 rotations, that at the end, secretly, you are still SO3 invariant in a discrete way, in the sense you are still isotropic. So I have a lattice, it is isotropic, and then you see it's well understandable that at large distances, where I don't see the the lattices anymore, I have isotropy, right? It's pretty intuitive.
So here it's very different of that discrete
subgroup of rotation.
Huh?
A discrete subgroup of
discrete rotation. Discrete subgroup
enough.
Here, how you recover the boost transformation, to me, sounds mysterious. Please, the perturbing level is clearly mysterious.
Can add to this the technical
but
level.
But what does anisotropic lattices also?
I don't know about anisotropic lattices, but at the technical levels, many of the lattices that you will look at will be characterized by higher rank tensors. Right? So when in the continuum limit, they would have to couple to a very higher dimensional operators, right? And so decouple in the scaling of lattice spacing going to zero.
But is it similar? Like there would be like Laplacian of phi whole square if you expand out the lattice action for scalars, and you know, you might ask the same question there. Right? I mean, if you write phi of x plus mu minus phi of x, it does every all derivatives in it. That's what I think it's. But it must be just that discrete symmetry is good enough.
Good enough to rule out rotation violating low dimension operators.
Yeah. But maybe something like that has to be done. You know, like, I mean,
the Lorentz group, the boosts are non-compact. So to have any subgroup of the boost, you need an infinite number of boosts.
I mean, no intensity.
But in practical calculations, you do everything in imaginary time. So you're really trying to restore rotation in that. You're not trying to directly restore or
but here, as you know, it's intrinsically, you are breaking at an intrinsic way. I don't see any subgroup that you can for the time and space.
If we are only doing a flat space theory and looking for a regulator, a short distance cutoff, then maybe we could go by that path. Define a theory by Euclidean lattice, by the analytic continuation of some Euclidean lattice theory. Of course, so we'd have to be sure it had the right analytic properties. But when we go to gravity, it seems so close.
But in the gravity models, in the continuity, if you want to do any practical calculation, you would live in imaginary time. That's a good thing first. So then the issue of non-compact, those are very funny. What you really want to be rephrasing the question in that regime as is to say, by restore Euclidean rotation. And that might be difficult, of course, if you start with an action which manifestly breaks this discrete subgroup of rotations at the fundamental level, and you might not be able to restore Euclidean. So it might be difficult to restore Euclidean rotation. But I don't think there's an issue with Lorentz that it's not about that. That doesn't have a problem.
I hear your words. I mean, in the lattice model, of course, you try to make sure that you do not break rotation invariance, because you have no interest in breaking it usually from the future. And that's why it's never really an issue, even if you start out with an anisotropic lattice.
Yeah.
I mean, if you really wanted to do that, well, you would, of course, not get Euclidean invariance, but I mean, you would, if you had some reason for doing it, that you want to restore an alternative, you would make sure that you only add terms which, by rescaling of this, could be mapped to an isotropic lattice. So it's never really a practical issue in lattice calculations, I would say, because you make sure that you only include such terms.
I mean, the focus of lattice is you doing only keep only the relevant terms. Of course, if you go to the scale that's close to lattice spacing, all kind of violations do happen on lattice. So you take the lattice
zero. I mean, the lattice action, of course, contains an infinite number of irrelevant terms.
That's
I mean,
right.
In a particular way.
Sure, yeah. So
what I was asking is that, I mean, when you do the calculations, a correlation function, go to the continuum limit by tuning the coupling constant, you know, the bare coupling constant is zero or something like that, you always get nice little circles, you know, which are invariant.
So if let me just say as a very, very stupid philosophical comment. So to me, the point is that in order to have an emergent Lorentz symmetry, you should probably rely on strong coupling. In the sense that, of course, a strong coupling has some energy of order lambda, some strong coupling appears, that a flow energy, something wide that can happen, and then you can have a dynamical principle that restores, not this small logarithmic behavior. But since this theory projected, this theory, or our theory, we have the same degrees of freedom in the entire and the infrared. If this is the case, we are not that happy, right? I mean, we should study, as you did, we should study with the theory of the infrared from spin system, which emerges spirality. Here we have the gravitational degrees of freedom already manifested in ultraviolet.
Right.
So this theory, and we like this theory because hopefully it can be weakly coupled all the way down to the infrared. In this context, which is the incalculable nice context we would love, it seems hard to have an emergent symmetry.
The other comment I wanted to make is that sometimes things can become very tricky. There is a well-known example, again due to Nielsen and Steve Schenker and some other people, that you take like U1 lattice gauge theory, you add a term which is the cosine of the log of the link variable, that can divide the link variable into the R theta. If you add cosine of theta, it looks like a relevant operator breaks gauge invariance. But what they found is that that's not true. That's actually an irrelevant operator. Am I right? Yeah, right. This is light from chaos business, mm-hmm. right? I mean, where you really don't have. I mean,
But there is a region where you do the symmetry. So there's a parameter running.
Right.
There's a phase transition.
That's right.
So, yes.
But you can take a continuum limit,
depends on where you
come
from, yes.
Right. Yeah. Where you actually get back a gauge invariance here.
Okay, any other questions?
So I guess I want to reiterate the question that I asked, and I think it's a physical and relevant question. Do you define the speed of light for each particle or each field as the fastest speed that the particles of that field can have, right? But that means we know that if you have two different speeds of light, quote-unquote light, for two different particles, then one of them, the faster one, can actually Cherenkov radiate in particles through, even if linearly they are decoupled at the nonlinear level, there is some coupling between the two fields. So there would be a Cherenkov radiation. So the superluminal, quote-unquote superluminal particles aren't really eigenstates of the system because they Cherenkov radiate until they are subluminal. So
not that it's what I don't fully understand. I mean, what you're saying is actually one of the most the nicest argument that polyvalent glass should give to fix delta C of proton.
Yeah.
So let's stick to this very physical example. So they say that this physical argument with cosmic rays as well. No? Since we don't see this Cherenkov radiation cosmic rays, and since due to the GKZ singularities that we have, then without doing any real precise computation, we argue that the proton cannot have a speed of light which is faster than the light itself.
Sure.
Otherwise, we would see that in proton rays. This is what you see has nothing to do with the fact that the proton itself is its own eigenstate. I mean, the proton will interact to minimal coupling with the photon, will emit photons, and still it's an eigenstate. I mean, the only fact is that the processes that are clearly forbidden with the three vertex proton-proton-photon, which is trivially zero in a Lorentz invariant theory, but energy momentum conservation, yes, not zero because of the different speed of light. So that's what happens. The proton emits
particle.
Emits particle until it slows down at the same speed of light.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's unusual, but you see that the proton remains an eigenstate as a proton.
Well, so it's
not a mixing between a photon and a photon. That's what
but you agree that a subluminal proton is a stable. It's stable in a sense.
Yeah, yeah. If you wish, you are right in the sense that a superluminal proton is itself is not stable. I mean, as soon as you produce it, in a flash, it will land for photons, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
In this sense, it's true.
Okay, one question.
Just a small comment. Of course, I don't have the universal resolution to these puzzles, but I just want to point out that it is not necessary that the respiration of Lorentz invariants, they have multiple species of particles, should be accidental. It could be possible to come up with a scenario where you have some form of symmetry where everybody belongs to the same multiple, let's say some maximum degree of supersymmetry. Where if you make sure that all the species have to share the same speed of light based on the extra symmetry, then you can eliminate the first problem, and the second problem becomes unimportant because basically once everybody shares the same speed of light, then you can basically show that it increases.
No, okay, good. This is a good point. It's actually, to me, it's the only possible way out, supersymmetry, roughly. Maxime also, I was mentioning yesterday too. I agree. I started to give a look, not deep look to that, but simply it seems not that easy to me to implement a supersymmetry in this context. Due to the higher degree of the operator, due to the fact that you have to work with the subalgebra of translation only, for supersymmetry, you don't have Lorentz. You might want to keep Lorentz exclusive despite not having Lorentz. So the framework is on the edge of the possibilities you can imagine. And the higher degree of the operators makes things a bit hard. So far, I didn't manage to work out a working model. But I'm sure that this is, if any, at the perturbative level, is the only solution, the only possible solution.
Okay.
What's my work?